Good evening and welcome to the World Affairs Council of Northern California. Tonight we are pleased to have with us Valentino Achukdan, the co-founder of the Valentino Achukdan Foundation. And I'd like to give to you the web address for his foundation, and that is www.valentino, V-A-L-E-N-T-I-N-O, one word, Achuk, A-C-H-A-K, DENG.org. So if any of you listening tonight on radio or any of you here in the audience want to learn more about the foundation and also how you can make contributions, and you'll hear later tonight why it's so important. Tonight's event is co-sponsored by the Human Rights Center at the University of California at Berkeley. My name is Eric Stover. I am the faculty director with the Human Rights Center and an adjunct professor of law and public health. I am honored to be your moderator this evening. The World Affairs Council of Northern California invites you to join us in seeking knowledge, expanding your networks, and discovering innovative solutions to global problems. More information about the organization, as well as a recording of tonight's program, can be found on our website at www.itsyourworld.org. If you are unable to attend a program, the Council offers two great ways to stay connected. You may either listen to our weekly radio show called It's Your World on Monday evenings on KQED, or visit our website for studio and video recordings of all our past programs. This evening's program is being recorded for future broadcast, and I'd like to thank our audio engineer, Dave Ogilvy. Please take note of the blue question cards on your seats. I would encourage you to write questions for Valentino, and council staff will come by to collect them. It would also be greatly appreciated if you could turn off all cell phones and anything else that might disturb the program. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's guest. Born in southern Sudan, Valentino Achukdan fled the country in the late 1980s during civil war, when his village was destroyed by the same type of militia that currently terrorizes Darfur. Dan spent 9 years in Ethiopian and Kenyan refugee camps, where he worked for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees as a social advocate and reproductive health educator. Finally, in 2001, he settled in Atlanta, Georgia. Don is perhaps best known for his collaboration with author Dave Eggers on What is the What?, the novelized version of Don's life story and experience as a refugee. A leader in the Sudanese diaspora, Don, along with Eggers, established the Valentino Achukdan Foundation in 2006 to help rebuild Sudanese communities by increasing access to educational opportunities. It's now time to join in welcoming Valentino Achukdan for tonight's speech.
Thank you, Professor Eric, and thanks everyone for sparing your valuable time to be here this evening. I know how difficult it is for someone to spare their time, especially after 5 p.m. on a work day. So I really appreciate your presence this evening. I am going to talk briefly about my past life, how I got separated and how I left Sudan in the 80s, and I will also talk about how I spent some of the years in the refugee camps in western Ethiopia and in northwestern Kenya. And then I will wind up with what I am doing currently, in combined with some of my life in the U.S. And I will turn it back to Professor Eric for moderation, with probably some of the questions that will come from among you. In 1987, I was separated from my family due to a civil war that was taking place between the government of Sudan, or what later became successive government of Sudan, and the Sudan People's Liberation Army, or the movement. The war many thought would be fought between the government soldiers and the rebels had evolved to include the civilians. And I was separated during one of the assaults by Morohalind in my village. Morohalind are the same group known today in Darfur as Janjaweed. And during the war times, the government had armed members of the Baggara and the Masiriya Arabs to carry out raids in the Denka villages of northern Bahr Ghazal and many different bordering towns up in southern Sudan. Mar el Bahr is located to the south of Darfur, and the community paid ultimate prices due to those Morohalind raids. So in 1987, Mar el Bahr was attacked, and I was separated from my family briefly, but at the same time, members of the Sudanese, southern Sudanese community were busy mobilizing young children to leave for refugee camps, which were in western Ethiopia or Kenya. And during my separation with my family, I happened to join groups or multitudes of families and children who were fleeing southern Sudan for Ethiopia. As a child, I thought that the journey would last for a day or weeks or so, but what I thought to be a day became weeks, and weeks became months, and I worked for 4 months, almost 5 months, from Mar el Bahr to Penyudo in western Ethiopia. During the trail, or during the journey, things became so difficult. We had run out of meals, we had to drink dirty water and eat anything that there was to eat. And at the same time, we were attacked and bombed by government air forces, because in southern Sudan at the time, any moving target was suspected by the government soldiers. And maybe we were thought of being rebels or rebel recruits, and we became the targets for bombardments. At the same time, the rebels movement was not well organized, so sometime we get confused, we would be sent to different directions, and it was difficult for us as kids to figure out who was there to help us. I also had witnesses incidents where people were dead and lying on the roadsides, you know, were common things to see. I even lost a friend of mine and left a friend of mine for dead, a friend who was asking for water or food and who I knew would die, but who at the same time, you know, knew that I had to die because help, or it would not be possible for me to return with food or water or anything that he needed. Would there be any? I arrived in Ethiopia in late 1987 and were resettled in Penyudo refugee camps. We spent roughly 3 years in Penyudo, and that is where I began my education. I started my school under a tree. And I remember very well that my first teacher in Penyudo did not have a pen and did not have a chalk or a chalkboard. And we did not have pens or exercise book. So the teaching was done orally. The teacher had to lecture, and when it come times for practicing writing, we had to sit out in the dirt in a circle sometimes, and the teacher has to teach us how to draw letters, A, B, C, D. And I remember having very difficult time to learn how to write letter B. And when you had a difficult time like that, the teacher sometimes has to scratch your finger very hard, and it hurt. So we learned a little bit, and then later on the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees recognized the fact that we were children and needed a future, and our future had to be given a priority. The UN supplied us with clothing, with pencils, and exercise book, which I believe were donated. And the schools were supported, and a camp came to the camp. We were peaceful for some time, but 3 years later, in 1990, the government of Mengistu Haile Mariam was overthrown. And the SPLA, not having good relationships with the Ethiopian rebels, had to leave Western Ethiopia, and our camp were always attached with the rebel because we were Southern Sudanese. The people we knew the most were the same members of the rebel groups. The only difference was that when they come to the camp, they are not rebel and they don't have guns. But when the SPLA had to leave Western Ethiopia, we also were asked by the new Ethiopian administration to leave the camp. Our departure was not peaceful. We were attacked by the Ethiopian soldiers. And I remember while crossing a river known as Gilo back to Southern Sudan, one day we were attacked and we lost over 2,000 members of our community, most of them young boys and young girls and women and children. And I remember one incident where a mother was shot dead on the roadside, and we were running, and her daughter struggling to breastfeed from a dead mother. My friends and I took that girl, we brought her to the Sudanese administration in the bordering town of Pashala. So Pashala was also another internally displaced camp inside Southern Sudan. And then the war in Southern Sudan had escalated at that time. The rebel groups had splintered and were fighting each other. The Sudanese government was bombarding and killing maybe all of them. And I remember a time when the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, charter plane would come with the medicine and food. And the moment they dropped the cargo, then the next minute the Sudanese high altitude bomber, the Russian made Antonov, would come and drop bombs on the same field. So Pashala was just like living in hell, and we left Pashala and had to walk again for Western Kenya. And I arrived in Kakuma in Western Kenya in August 1992. So at that time we were again received by the UNHCR, and we crossed into the border town with the help of the International Committee of the Red Cross, and Kakuma camp was set up again of more than 30,000 unaccompanied minors from Southern Sudan that were in Western Ethiopia. Only 12,000 made it to Western Kenya, Northwestern Kenya. And again, the UN set up camps. The situation in Kakuma now was more severe because Kakuma is a semi-arid zoned region. The rains were bare in Kakuma, and there weren't fruits and vegetables, and so everything we had to eat in Kakuma had to be provided by the UN, making us dependent on what the UN could give. And I remember in Kakuma when people were just hungry, the UN provided some food, but the food would not last for the given times. Again, the Sudanese community pushed for our education, and the UN, with the help of the Kenyan government and the Sudanese community at the camp, again started building schools. And Kakuma now has more than 20 primary schools and 3 secondary schools. I went to school in Kakuma, and then it was in Kakuma where I became an active member of the youth and became a leader of over 6,000 Sudanese, Ugandan, Ethiopian, Eritrean, Rwandan refugee youth in the camp. And I was trained by IRC, the International Committee, the International Rescue Committee, to be a community health motivator. So I was trained in reproductive health and HIV/AIDS counseling, and also peer counseling. And I worked with all the UN agencies at the camps, and we established youth groups and social action teams. Some members of sport clubs and drama clubs, who would go out on the weekends and help build homes or help clean houses, and places where vulnerable community members live. I left Kakuma in 2001. And unfortunately, it happened that my flight to the U.S. fell on September 11th. So I left Kakuma and was stranded in Nairobi. My flight was canceled, and I spent 2.5 weeks in Nairobi, but was allowed eventually to come to the U.S. I arrived in New York and then was told that my flight was rearranged, and I had to go to a different place. I was originally supposed to come to San Jose, which I really liked. But now when I was told that you have to go to a new place, I first of all thought about South Dakota and Fargo, where it is horribly cold and snows, and I would not be able to handle that. Because I had seen pictures of some of my friends who were there and were in snow and wanted to go back. But eventually I was told that my destination was going to Atlanta, to be Atlanta. So I went to Atlanta on September 26, 2001, and began my new life there. Well, to cut it short, it was in Atlanta where I started doing public speakings for the Lost Boys Foundation that was founded by Mary Williams. And through my public speaking, I realized that I was not doing enough, because I was speaking with groups like you here maybe once a week or twice a week, and I did not have time because I was working full time, and I would take my lunch break to go to speak with high schools or colleges or at corporations. And then one day I thought about what I would do to share enough of my story with people. And also I thought about how I would become an advocate of the people of South Sudan. And I knew very well that I left a country where over 2.5 million people had been killed between 1983 and later 2005 when they would sign a peace agreement. And I knew that I had left a country where over 4 million people were internally displaced and lived in horrible makeshift camps in northern Sudan. And I knew that I was leaving a region where nearly a million people had left the country to become refugees, and I was one of them. So I had then decided that I needed to write my story or write a memoir, but in order to do that, I needed to be to have a writer, a professional writer, to help me put the story together. And then I went to Mary William and asked her to help me locate a writer to work with. And Mary agreed and made a research and then wrote to Dave asking him to help me write my story. Then I met with Dave in Atlanta in 2002. And that weekend we were celebrating a birthday for 150 Sudanese youth in Atlanta. We happened to have one birthday because during our process of coming to the U.S., many of us did not remember our birth date. And so the UN agencies has to give us date. And January the 1st being an easy day to remember, you know, became the birthday for so many of us. And we used that date sometime for raising funds. So that birthday was a fundraising event at the same time. And that's when I met with Dave. From then on, we worked on the process of the book for almost 4 years. And also in 2003, we went to Sudan together, and I reunited with my family. Yeah. Currently, when the book was published, Dave decided that all the proceeds were going to come to me. And then I decided with him together that if that is the case, I need a good amount of the proceeds to go toward community project. And we founded the Valentino Achagning Foundation. Then I went back to Sudan, did an assessment, and realized that all of the NGOs operating in Sudan and the in southern Sudan and the new government for southern Sudan had emphasize investing on primary education. And I figured that these kids who would finish primary school will have to go to secondary school. And my concern was actually the girls who even before finishing primary school would be married off. And so how do you help them like that? So we decided that we were going to build a boarding school. And because a boarding school will provide an environment where the girls would be on boarding and then go home maybe for 1 month, and because girls in Sudan, you know, are the same people who take care of their young siblings and do household duties than boys. The future for women in Sudan had to be decided, and we thought that we would be one of the factors that will help that. So I went back last year to begin the construction of Mariel Bay Secondary School, and we had just completed classrooms, offices, and we'll start classes on April 30th. I'm going back tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the work I am doing right now, and Dave is helping me do all of this. So the book was done, we built the school, and the struggle continue. But from here, I will hand it back over to Professor Eric.
Thank you, Valentino. And we made an agreement you'll call me Eric and not Professor. Well, I'd like to go back to your childhood, or go back to Mariel Bay, and tell us a little bit about the town before you left. I mean, I know you were only 6 years old, but What's the town like, and what growing up there do you think instilled values in you? Can you talk a little about that? I know you were only six at the time, but can you describe what the town was like and then what happened when the attack came?
I might have been a little older than a 6 years old boy when I left Mario Albay, because my memories seem to disapprove of the age. But Mario Albay was a peaceful town. It was a small but growing town. People were happy. Almost every family has what they value so much, the cows. And I remember many cows, many goats, many people. There used to be happy weddings. There used to be happy celebrations in towns. And I remember my father was a businessman. And I remember the time when many Arabs would come on caravans. You know, like it would be a group of 50 or 100 businessmen coming from the north, all of them riding camels with their goods to sell. Sometimes horses. So it was a commercial town, a busy town, and a happy town. I have never seen any horror or a fight in Mario Albay. But then when the war started in 1983, I began to see many youth organizing themselves into groups. And these now were not the normal, the traditional warrior groups have spears. This new group have AK-47s or guns, and we're trainings and we're singing. So I thought sometime we joined because we thought these are people we knew, but this was a rebellion. This was a mobilization. And in the evening we would see people sitting around the radio. Now I would know later that this was the rebels' radio, you know, where the rebel leader was talking to people and asking for a must rebellion and mass protest. And then we saw this incident where the government troops in town left without notice. And then a week later, the same government troops came back to burn Mario Albay. They burned the whole market. And even my own house, I remember seeing Mario Albay hatch. Everything was burned. And then we ran away. We stayed outside Mario Albay and returned later. But now the rebellion was growing. And we would see young men leaving. They were coming to Western Ethiopia to train as rebel to go and fight back. And then some time later, then the Morahaline came. This was a group of rebels that ride on of men wearing gown and caps on their head and riding on horseback and killing people. So that's what became of Mario Albay, but Mario Albay was a good town.
When you fled, in the United States, many people know about Sudan because of Darfur, and but also because of the lost boys of Darfur. But I've always wondered, what about the lost girls? And were there some thousands and thousands of boys who fled, but what happened when the attack came and you fled? Was it in communities or when you fled to Ethiopia? Did you go with your parents?
You know, the shortcoming of the lost boys' story is that almost no emphasis was given to the fact that the communities in Sudan were not only made, or the children in Sudan were not only boys, there were girls. And even if there were no girls who fled with us, then something had happened to the girls who were with the families. So when we left Sudan to Ethiopia, there were girls in the camp with us, and even in Kakuma. What happened was that many of the girls, like our age mate, got married off at the very early age. You know, in the camp where there were more men than girls, and many of the girls were married off, and if anyone read the book, then you could tell of the royal girls of Pinedu. These were girls that were my age mate, and we were together. And now, coming to Kakuma, these girls were women. And when our process of coming to the U.S. started, no families were allowed to be screened for resettlement. The emphasis was only given to unaccompanied minors, and they had what they called P1, unaccompanied minors, and P2, which is the second priority. And based on this assessment, you know, many of the girls who were with us remained in the camps. There also were fewer girls who came. They might have been, their number might be 100 or less, you know. But then they couldn't speak up. We came from a male-dominated society. Maybe they left the task to members of our group who were men. And that's why we don't hear about girls and what happened to them. They were there. And in any conflict, and I personally would admit that, the woman suffered the most than men. So you can imagine that of the 22 war conflict in southern Sudan.
So what started the war? I mean, we know that the first Sudanese war went from 1955 to 1972, and then there was peace, and it started in 1983 and shortly after your journey, and ends in 2005. Well, what began the war in 1983? What was the chemistry that...
Well, the chemistry is that the war in 1983 was triggered by the abrupt abrogation of the 1972 Addis Ababa peace agreement. In 1972, the southern Sudanese rebels, then known as Anyanya Want, had negotiated a peace settlement with the government of Namheri. And the rebels were promised self-determination after 3 years. And then they stopped the war, but then 10 years later, that peace agreement was finally abrogated and a Sharia law was declared as the law of the country, and given the religious factor in Sudan, many people in the south turned to be either Christians or people who worship the African religions. So as far as I know, that's what triggered the 1983 rebellion. Another thing also was the oil factor. The government had discovered more oil fields in the south. And any time an oil field is discovered, that area automatically was declared as the north. And you see the small groups of southern Sudanese who were educated and knew this was what was happening, joined rebellion. So that was headed by Dr. John Goreng, a U.S. educated PhD holder. So, and he fought a war that he knows.
As you were fleeing, there's a number of questions from the audience. What kept you alive, and what kept you alive, and what gave you hope that you could continue?
Well, what kept me alive was the fact that I did not want to give up until the last minute. I was determined to persevere. I was determined to keep on going. And I knew that if I stop, I knew that if I give in to hunger, if I give in to thirst, if I give in to bullet that hadn't touched me, if I lost hopes, then that would be the end of me. So my hope was that let me go until the time comes when I don't, when I would not be able or be capable to endure the hardships. And the other thing was that I was not alone. The entire region of southern Sudan was affected by the war. And near me were thousands of children who also were going through the same difficulty. And I saw no reason for me to single myself out and say that I am the one who is facing the most horror. So that factor helped me push on. The other thing was that I knew that one day, one time, I had to leave and I had to make sure that more people don't suffer. I knew that maybe one day I would be the one who would speak for the voiceless, and it is becoming true.
And when you, why the United States? I mean, you at some point you'd worked 10 years, I believe, with the UNHCR. And then how did you learn that you could go to the United States? And then what was the process coming to the United States? What did you have to go through?
It was a process. I did not know that I was going to come to the U.S. You know, America is in many songs of the Dinka people and southern Sudanese. Everything good is always compared to America. Right. And when we were in the camp, while I went to secondary school, the 12th grade, and had done a diploma course on Mountain Kenya with the National Outdoor Leadership School, I was sponsored by Knowles in Wyoming. So I had come to know what America is and what I could get if I come here. But when the process started, I think it was some kind of an agreement between the State Department and the UNHCR. The UNHCR at the camp has this program where they would look at the cases of refugees who have stayed in the camp longer and then maybe transfer them to resettle in their third countries. In our case, we had lived in the camp. The war in southern Sudan was not coming to an end. So we had, and we had well-founded fear of persecution. And we had to be resettled. So when that happened, it appeared that the U.S. government has accepted to resettle a certain number of southern Sudanese youth. And the agent, there's an organization called JVA, Joint Voluntary Agency, were sent to the camp to recruit, to process cases, and we had to be interviewed by lawyers, and we had to give our testimonies and be approved for the U.S. So that's how we knew we were coming to the U.S. And then all of a sudden, a first Buffalo plane landed in the camp to take the first group. This was in November 2000, and then we knew exactly that we were going to come to the U.S. That's how I ended up here.
So you step off the plane in Atlanta and you're learning to live in the United States. What struck you as odd? Were any peculiar things about this new home and these new people you were living among?
So many things. Starting from a train ride inside the airport. I was used to hair strips when I was dropped, and then we had to be in this plane for like maybe 5 minutes or 10 minutes. I was like, what an airport is this? You know, and then what struck me then was when my caseworker received us and put me in this SUV, and we were driving to Clarkston, and then on the way we were on High 285, the busiest one, and I was looking at so many cars. I had almost asked him to be driving on the roadside in case of an accident. We had somewhere to branch. So many things.
Were you alone when you arrived, or were you with a group?
I came alone. I remember I told you that my plan was changed. So I was the only person going to Atlanta at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was brought to Clarkston, and then I had to join three of my fellow Sudanese who had resettled before me and stayed with them in an apartment.
And what sort of jobs did you get? when you were starting out in Atlanta?
My first job was at the Best Buy. I had gone in and was given a job, and I liked this job because I was a cashier, and sometime we had to do the merchandise, or sometime rearrange the things on the shelf. And I was put on the sections of radios and computers and TVs, and I really liked that because I could switch the radio to the song that I like and kept on enjoying that. I had a good supervisor, but it was a part-time job. And then my second job was at a small store, a small Christmas gift store. And my job was to wrap Christmas gift, and even met with this idea of something called Santa Claus at that time, which I didn't know. So it was fun. But I did those two jobs for less than 2 months, and then I got a job at the Atlanta Decorative Art Center. It was an interior design showroom. And it was a good job at this time. I became the store supervisor. And that was the job I did until I started working on the book with Dave.
And how about your studies? When you arrived, how did you begin? Did you go to high school, or were you in secondary school? And
I had completed high school back in Kenya. So when I came, I bought GED textbooks at a bookstore, and I read them, and I went and took my GED and passed it. So with that, I had cleared the way through college. And then I applied to Georgia Perimeter College. It was a community college, and I was accepted.
And then you went to Allegheny
College. Then I went to Allegheny.
And what's your major there? Because I know you're...
I wanted to do the international affairs and international relationships. I've not completed the degree program because we published the book in 2006. There was so much public interest, and I was handling a different kind of publicity. So I decided to take a leave of absence, and I went to Sudan and began build construction of the second school to help me readjust to this new life.
And I know many people will be interested, how, since Dave Eggers' book, What is the What, is really a fictionalized account, but it's based on yours, how did you agree with him to let him tell your story instead of you telling it? How did you feel about that?
We worked together for 3 years, and then it wasn't coming. And, you know, what is very important about our partnership was that we did not just start off as a writer and a subject. We got to know each other really well. So we went to Sudan together and met members of my family. My father regarded Dave as his son. Mm-hmm. So we have a certain kind of relationship between us. And this important connection that helped us to trust each other. So when we worked in the book, and then I knew that Dave was a writer, and a creative writer. Whatever way we'll do this story, it will get to the point where we needed it. And that is getting the story in the hand of the people in the way that someone reads it and makes sense with it. So one day he wrote to me, was like, Valentino, we have really tried hard, but I think maybe we novelize this book that will allow me to stretch, you know, my writing here and there, but still keep the story the same. And I said, my email back was simple, you know, I said, you are a technician, do what is necessary. And that's how we novelized the book.
And has it changed your life?
Yes.
And how so?
an example is I'm now speaking here mm-hmm. and I'm flying between Africa and here to attend events. And then what is really important about this book is that the connection I'm establishing with the readers. There's hardly someone who has read the book who has come to me and said that he hasn't got something to use or he hasn't been inspired. That's what I wanted. Not to make this story mine alone, but to share it with other people, and so that we can maybe find something to do with that story. The book is doing that as we speak, and that has changed my life, and also it's changing other people's life, and it's giving us other reason to think about what we could do.
In 2005, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed between the North and the South in Sudan, and I believe elections are going to be held in 2010, I think in July of 2010. What do you think is going to happen? Do you have fears about the election, and will peace hold?
As a member of a country or a region that only came out from war in 2005, you know, I still have normal fear that anything could happen and things could spill, but I always have this thinking and personality, and I could be wrong, and you can correct me, is that I'm optimistic that the people of Southern Sudan and of Sudan in general want peace and are ready for it. We have to help them realize and appreciate the opportunities and peace that we have, that those elections will be good. Mm-hmm. In the southern context, it will be an election that will determine whether or not the South can succeed. If the South vote to succeed, then this was an internationally supported peace agreement, and every protocol there was witnessed by the international community. The people of the South had to be given their rights. If the whole country votes for unity, then that has to be allowed to happen. You know, what worries me currently is the situation in Darfur. I wish that what is happening in Darfur could be brought to an end sooner, and so that 2011 comes at a time when the whole country is at peace.
Well, speaking of Darfur, then, we know last March that the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants against President Omar al-Bashir of Sudan. What do you think of that? Does that concern you? Is that something that should have been done or should not have been done? There's quite a bit of debate about it. And how could that affect the elections, possibly?
It concerns me because it's coming at this critical time. We need peace in Darfur. And the person who is holding the stick, the president, is indicted. Would we negotiate with him or not? And if not, then he's the one who's still the president of the country. And what worries me so much about that is that the victims, the internally displaced Darfurians or Darfurian refugees, still remains the victims. Even after the indictment was made, 8 organizations were expelled, and the immediate victims, the immediate consequences after that is faced by the people who are supposed to be helped. So what should be done? Because that happened, because the same president who is indicted still is the one in control of things in Darfur.
But if you had the chance to address the International Criminal Court and the chief prosecutor who built the case against President al-Bashir, what would you say to them?
I would not have that chance in the first place, but I don't know.
But if you did?
What I would say is that the focus should be put on the victims first, who are the internally displaced Darfurians, the children who are dying right now, the mothers who are dying right now, the women who are being raped.
So you're saying that there should be humanitarian assistance, but not necessarily the arrest warrants at this time?
If it affects Like, what happened if 100,000 people die before the president is in the court? Is that worth the indictment?
Mm-hmm.
It might be. The indictment is for the purpose of justice. But the problem is there are just these helpless refugees in the camp. What could be done to them? Maybe there need to be a shift of paradigm to do something that can just reach these people at risk and at a very short time. I'm a victim of the war in the past, and I would not allow anyone to die to get someone.
One of the, a question from the audience is then, what if you had a chance to speak to President al-Bashir, what would you say to him?
The president is in control of things and he can bring peace to that country. What would the president feel if his children were in the internally displaced camp? See, I would ask him to find out any way, any meaningful way to negotiate with the rebels. I would ask him to bring about immediate ceasefire in Darfur. If we have a ceasefire, and then the politician, the rebels, and the government can negotiate, even if it takes 10 years, my worries is that people are dying. Okay? Bring about immediate ceasefire, allow the humanitarian organization to operate, save life, and then hold peaceful negotiation. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about non-violent, but in this case, it's really a very critical situation. Because you have the rebel attack. I am very sorry.
You are listening.
Yeah. So I think that that the president need maybe the, and when we talk about Bashir, we are talking about the systems. It's not just one man. He has his cabinets. He have his generals in the field. And so it's that system to figure out a way of talking with the rebel. And also we cannot...
It's the president, he's an insistent.
We can't... It's not the president, okay. It's just my busy self. The rebels, on the other hand, you know, have to be made responsible. Because if we're talking about bringing peace, maybe you can talk about the government and about Omar Bashir all the time. And then maybe by talking about Bashir all the time, we might be making the rebel think that what they're doing is right. Sometimes their attack, their anger, their refusal to negotiate with the government is what adds into the continuation of the conflict. So we need to look at both parties together, because I cannot talk to Bashir and forget or leave the fact that the rebels are against Bashir. Bashir will feel that he's being cornered.
Mm-hmm.
It is both groups. When we are talking about peace in Darfur, always is the rebel and the government.
Well, shifting away from the International Criminal Court, what about Western companies that invest in Sudan, and particularly southern Sudan and the oil fields, and also governments like China? What should their role be?
I think they all need to cooperate with the parties that conflict, both the rebels and the government. Of course, we might make mistake if we talk, if the Western companies, you know, target the government or talk about government more than they do about the rebels, then we get then the government gives us a position, and that's what we don't need to do. The government says, oh, he is targeting me. If we talk about the rebels all the time and we don't talk about the government, the rebel will say they are being targeted. And at any conflict, you know, there are always parties involved. And like if you talk with China is on the side of the government, then China tells the government that the U.S. government is targeting the government for certain interests. if the government, if the rebels seem that they're sympathetic to the U.S., then we have already divided groups with friends that they know, and it becomes difficult to get them together.
Because we know with the Chinese government that something like almost 90% of the small arms have actually come from China, and so much of the conflict is fueled by that. Is there a special role for China out of other countries in putting influence on the government and the rebels?
These I don't know details about them. Mm-hmm. But all I know is that there is some interest from China in the government or in the conflict. I don't know.
Well, and going back to the What is the What, the book, I think a lot of people will be curious about that title. And what exactly is the What? What's the story of the What?
The story comes from the Dinka fox tales. The Dinka, and there are several stories the Dinka people tell about creations. And the Dinka people believe that when God created them, God just did not let them go. God gave them a choice to choose between the kettles and the unknown, the what. And then when the war came later, the Dinka people fired with spears and locally made weapons. And then they were facing this, for example, Moralin were armed with AK-47 and hand-launched missiles. Then they began to review what happened in the past. Why wouldn't they be able to make this? And that feeds into the notion where the Dinka, you know, choose the cow, and then the other people choose the unknown and have to go research and make a sophisticated weapon. That's in that context, just to put it simple. But then when it comes to my story, it's related to many details that happen in my life. And then I revisit this story, and it's like, what is happening? What is going to be this?
A number of people in the audience have wanted to know about how other Sudanese have accepted your story, either in Sudan, who may know about it, or here in the United States. What do they think of your story?
I have not had a single day where someone came to me and told me that there was something wrong with their story or they're upset with it. This is the story that I've seen people read in South Sudan, and there's no single flight that I took to South Sudan where I was not seeing an aid worker reading the book. I think it's become something that the aid workers read, whether someone is from Canada or U.S., I've always seen someone reading What is the What or holding it in the hand. On my flight in here from Sudan, Southern Sudan, I was sitting with someone next who was reading it.
It must have been difficult. You must have had to look over her shoulder.
I had to tell her that, hey, I'm the one in the book.
But did she believe you?
She did. I was sitting at the airport, you know, waiting for my flight, and then she came and sat next to me and was reading the book. The flight was delayed, and we spent 3 hours. And then we went into the plane. I went and sat, and then she followed me and had to sit next to me. So we were in the plane, and I said, this is not fair. At least I have to tell her that I am the one in the book. And I told her, and she could not accept. So I showed her my passport, and she was like, no way. This cannot be you. How come? We're now friends. We email each other.
Well, it shows you the power of storytelling. I mean, I work in my field is in human rights, and there's so many reports written, but the power of a well-told story and, of course, a compelling one. Yeah. What makes you, someone in the audience wants to know, what makes you proud to be Sudanese?
I was born Sudanese, not by choice, and I am originally from there. I know Sudan has a tough time at this time. There have been so many conflict, but one day they'll come to an end, because any great nation that we have today came through some shortcomings, and they eventually will make it. Sudan will be one of the nations that is at peace in the future. It's just about time. Yeah. And just like I'm proud of the U.S. where I live, I'm proud of Sudan, where I'm originally from.
Do you think you'll ever go back?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. But I might not go back to live, but to visit, and I have the family there. I am linked to Sudan directly. Mm-hmm. My family is there. I have over 40 brothers. Yeah, my dad is married to many wives, and I'm not going to be like him. And so I like the roots, and then I like my new country. I'm an American. I have a U.S. passport, which is really good.
Mm-hmm. Well, what does the world need to know and understand about Sudan that we probably don't yet know or understand?
Not that I know, but we have... Sudan is a member of the global community. What is happening in Sudan should be seen as something that is happening in our neighborhood, and we can't stop it. Mm-hmm. That's one thing we need to know about. So it's not a country far away. It's a country on the global. It's a member of the global community, and we share in that as humans. A human catastrophe in South Sudan or in Sudan as a whole is the same as any human catastrophe happening anywhere. We need to know that about Sudan. I'm happy many of you have come here tonight. Share in that contact, or you would not spend your time to be here. Thank you for that.
And can you tell us, what can we do? What should people do to help bring peace in Sudan?
Not give up. They'd find many ways to end the conflict in Sudan. Talk to your friends, your neighbor, or your family members about the issues, about things that are happening in Sudan. If it is in southern Sudan, yes, we need development there. People are building school, kids are going back to school. There are financial crises, the worst financial crisis. If we have them in the U.S., then we should think about those who did not have enough, what is happening to them. You know, talk to your congressmen, talk to your leaders about the issue in Sudan. If what had been tried have not worked out so far, then we need new strategies.
Valentino.
To bring peace in Sudan.
I know the World Affairs Council and the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center have been honored to have you here and to tell us of and inspire us as to what we can do. And so I want everyone to join in thanking Valentino. And
it's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you and good night.
Thanks.